We are continuing in Mark chapter 14, and today we're going to look at verses 53 to 65. We last left off where Jesus was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane. They bound him and were carting him off to the various people that would be trying him. This was done under Judas' instruction. He set it up. He's the one that gave the orders to bind him and take him away. And the disciples have scattered, one with a little bit of drama involved as well. Now, let's read verses 53 to 65. I'll warn you ahead of time, we're going to read these verses, and then we're going to set things up. But the most of the class is going to be setting things up, and then we'll come back and look at these events. But let's read verses 53 to 65 out of Mark 14.
When I was with you day after day in a temple.
Hang on.
No, try again. Mark.
Mark 14.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Try again.
Well, it's close.
Nice verses, but.
Okay. Mark 14, 53. Yeah.
53 to 65.
Okay, here we go. Take two. And they led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes came together. And Peter had followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. And he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another, not made with hands.' Yet even about this, their testimony did not agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, 'Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?' But he remained silent and made no answer. Again the high priest asked him, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?' And Jesus said, 'I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven.' And the high priest tore his garments and said, 'What further witnesses do we need? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision?' And they all condemned him as deserving death. And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and strike him, saying to him, 'Prophesy.' And the guards received him with blows."
All right. So we need to, we will benefit from, I don't know if we need to, but we'll benefit from putting this in perspective. Jesus actually, before this whole thing is over, will undergo six separate, I'm going to use the word trials. They're not all really technically maybe trials, but examinations by others. Three of them are religious, led by the Jewish leaders. Those three happen first. And then there are three in front of Gentiles, officials. What we see in verse 53 is actually trial number two. Okay? So we'll get that all straightened out. We're going to take a look at trial number one. But before we do that, we need to understand how the Jewish legal system worked and what it was based on. So first of all, I want to go over to Deuteronomy chapter 16, and we're first going to look at verses 18 through 20. Now, Deuteronomy is a book that was written by Moses. In many respects, it is the second law. The people of Israel are about to go into the promised land, and God gives specific instruction that includes the law found in the book of Exodus, but goes into great detail about how they're to live in the promised land when they get there. That's what Deuteronomy does. In Deuteronomy, it sets up a legal system and a lot of things about how they are going to handle themselves to be a people who are a just people. But let's read Deuteronomy chapter 16, 18 through 20 to begin with.
"You shall appoint judges and officers in your towns, that the Lord your God is giving you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality. You shall not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and subverts the cause of the righteous. Justice, and only justice, you shall follow, and you may live and inherit the land that the Lord your God is giving you.
Okay. So God calls them to have an upright, effective, undistorted justice system. Now, he doesn't give a lot of detail about how they are to go about doing that. The Jews worked very hard at implementing that. And by the time of Jesus, it's been going on a long time and is well refined and has a lot of fundamental rules that are strictly adhered to. Every town with 120 or more men would have a synagogue. Okay? Now, they're called synagogues, but when you get to the justice side, they're called the Sanhedrin. And the word, they come from a root word that means to gather. So they have a gathering. And in there are 23 men. They prescribed it to be odd, an odd number, so there would be no ties as they passed their decisions down of justice. When you hear the elders, that's these men. When you see in the New Testament, for the most part, there are exceptions. People are just recognized as an elder, kind of a person in a town. And I don't mean elder by old, elder by leader. But in this specific group, that their title for them was elders, one would be in charge, and he would be the ruler. So you see the rulers and the elders, that's the titles that they're throwing around when they're talking about the court system. Now, these rulers, we think of ruler, we might think of a dictator or somebody in the political realm. Their role was not to rule the town or to rule the synagogue. The word that we would translate ruler most of the time really means they were the chief judge. They were there to educate what came in front of them. They were to lead the group of 23 to make right decisions. Even in towns with less than 120, they wouldn't have a synagogue, but they would still have a group that would come together of appointed judges, and it would be an odd number, and there would be a ruler. So every community of Jews had this system.
Rick,
okay. Yes.
Excuse me. Was this like a follow-up from when Moses' father-in-law said, "Well, go point guys for tens and hundreds and thousands"?
I mean, it's similar. But the real charge for this comes out of what we read in Deuteronomy.
Okay.
Their response to the directions that Moses gave them was this system.
Okay.
Okay, so as they populated the land, this is what they came up with on how they were going to judge the land and be fair to everybody.
And these judges were called the Sanhedrin?
Well, and doesn't that sound confusing? Because we keep talking about the Sanhedrin, and I'm going to tell you about that now. That's the great Sanhedrin. When we see the Sanhedrin mentioned in the New Testament, that's usually the great Sanhedrin, which existed only in Jerusalem. And that was more or less, very much more, but a little bit less than the way we would think about the Supreme Court. They were the court of courts, the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem.
It's going to be a lot like the Mormon setup today, right?
I have no idea what the Mormon
setup. They have local groups in each town, has their elder board and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't know, so I can't really go down that path very far. But, so you have the great Sanhedrin. Now that's a little bit different. That was made up of 24 priests, 24 elders, that's selected among the people, appointed, and 24 scribes and Pharisees. So the scribes and Pharisees have a specific place in there, and they all have 24, and yet the Sanhedrin is 71. If you take those three and add them together, that's 72. So somebody had to set out, and the high priest was always there. He was the ruler or leader, the one that would be the tiebreaker and that kind of a thing. So that's how they got their odd number. There's 72, but one sets out for any given court system. And I don't have any information about how they chose the one to set out or not set out, but you have the high priest there that is always in the Sanhedrin. Yes, sir?
How are the 24 chosen?
I have absolutely no idea. I just know they were appointed based on the I have some intuitive answers to that, but I have nothing based on facts. I probably ought to keep my intuitive answers quiet, okay? Because I really don't know. But they had the 24 elders, 24 chief priests, and by the way, these people were drawn up out of the lower Sanhedrins, okay? So they were picking amongst people who were selected locally in that Jerusalem area and drawing them up into this court, with the exception of the high priest. He was there just by being the high priest. They dealt with all kinds of legal matters, criminal, civil, whatever. If it was a decision that needed to be made about a legal matter, they were the ones to do it. We really need to take a look at what their rules were when we look at what happened to Jesus, because their rules were violated at every turn throughout what we're going to read about. So first of all trials were public, open to the public. It was required that the court, the Sanhedrin, would provide both prosecution and defense. They would go out and seek witnesses on both sides at every turn. Any accusation to be considered truthfully made required two or three witnesses. That's confusing words to me, but they pulled it out of the Old Testament. That's the words that Moses gave. You don't accept an accusation against somebody unless you've got two or maybe three witnesses. Why two or three? I don't know how to respond to that, but nonetheless, to be a false witness was a severe crime with a severe punishment. Go over to Deuteronomy 19, and we're going to read verses 15 through 21. We've got to see this and let Deuteronomy say it to us, and that just magnifies what we might understand here. Deuteronomy 19, 15 to 21.
A single witness shall not suffice against a person for any crime or for any wrong in connection with any offense that he has committed. Only on the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses shall a charge be established. If a malicious witness arises to accuse a person of wrongdoing, then both parties of the dispute shall appear before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who are in office in those days. The judges shall inquire diligently, and if the witness is a false witness and has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him as he had meant to do to his brother. So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and the rest shall hear and fear, and shall never again commit any such evil among you. Your eye shall not pity. It shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot.
Okay. So they tell them basically, don't soft pedal your justice. As a part of not soft pedaling your justice, don't take lightly a false witness. If somebody testifies falsely, what did this passage say was supposed to happen to them?
They were supposed to get the same sentence as the guy they were accusing.
Whatever sentence would have gone against the accused would go then against them. So if you go and claim that your brother or another person murdered your brother, and you find out later that was done falsely, what was the penalty for murder?
Death.
Stoning. So what are you going to do to that false witness? Stone them. So they would receive the same penalty as would have been given out against the person that they were accusing. That's pretty severe. And right in the passage it says, this will discourage people from these kinds of behaviors. Yeah, you're only going to testify falsely against somebody for murder once. I mean, that's pretty obvious. Okay? All right. So if the court pronounces a death sentence, you've got to wait 24 hours before you execute them. You can't do an execution the same day you pronounce the sentence. And the reason for that was in order to see if maybe some other piece of evidence might come up that would exonerate the person who had this testimony against them. No trials at night. Judges must fast during the trial. No trials on the Sabbath, on a feast day, or the day before a feast day. If judges had a unanimous verdict, the criminal went free. Now, to us, that sounds really weird because we expect a unanimous verdict. But the logic amongst the Jews when they set this up was that a unanimous verdict against somebody lacked the idea of mercy. It was too harsh. If you guys are all against them, then there must be something else going on here. It's kind of the attitude they had. So if you had a unanimous verdict, the criminal went free. Voting occurred. You can tell by the odd number. They didn't expect to get a unanimous verdict, did they? They wanted an odd number so the tie would be broken. And they expected a lot of them to be close. Or you don't need an odd number even yet. But the voting occurred from the youngest first, so that those who were more established or were mentors or those younger men would not set the stage and these other guys would just follow them in their voting. So the young people had to take the younger people, I don't know how young that meant, but the younger people had to take their stand first so that the more established people wouldn't just sway the court by their vote. No self-incrimination. You could not ask somebody to incriminate themselves. A confession was meaningless unless collaborated by witnesses. And by the way, that's true in our world too. Rules for grand jury, you can't just take a confession. You also have to have some collaborating evidence to bring an indictment against somebody. So no self-incrimination was a lot like taking our Fifth Amendment. The court could bring no charges against somebody. The charges would come from outside the court. And when they got to the court, then the purpose of the court, we read it over there, they will diligently investigate it. So they can do a lot of investigation. They can take their time. It isn't like all the evidence has to be there to start the trial like we think of today. They can take their time and look into things more. They needed to investigate it thoroughly to find out what the truth was, but the charges came from outside the court, from a person. A person could come and bring a charge against somebody, or from some other place. And we read in there, no bribes. You can't go out and pay somebody in the course of their testimony. So the Jewish trial had three parts. The first one was the arraignment. And we said arraignment, you could say trial. It all busts all these rules. The second one is the trial. The arraignment happened in front of Annas, and we'll get to that. The trial that we've got here in Mark happened in front of Caiaphas. And then there's a public retrial after daybreak the next morning. Try to cover everything up. So first of all, let's look at the arraignment trial, the one in front of Annas. Go over to John chapter 18. John chapter 18, we're going to look at verses 12 and 13 right now. We'll look at some more later. John 18, 12 and 13.
So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. First they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people.
Okay, so that we start out in front of Annas. So why Annas? Who is Annas in all this? Well, yeah, he's the father-in-law of Caiaphas. And it says here, Caiaphas was the high priest that year. Well, Annas had been the high priest for 5 or 6 years, about 20 years earlier. For whatever reason, the Romans ousted him. We don't really know why, but he got crosswise with the Roman government, and they set him aside. There were 5 high priests between Annas and Caiaphas. All 5 of them were sons of Annas. At the time of Jesus, he'd run out of sons, and now a son-in-law, Caiaphas, is the high priest. Sound like a mafia family yet? It will before we're done if it doesn't already. Now, so the title of high priest is kept for life. If we were to roll the clock back a few years, you could expect any time they addressed anybody that was currently or ever had been, they would address him as president or Mr. President or President Trump or Bush or whatever. That doesn't, they've decided to say Mr. in front of it instead of president, I think when they want to show some disrespect, I don't know. But anyway, Annas was hated by the Jews, most of them anyway, because he was the one leading, had the power, and was benefiting from all the temple corruption. It was common knowledge what was going on. As a matter of fact, the temple operations that Jesus cleared the temple twice, the common vernacular was that was called the Bazaars of Annas. That was his money pit. And his whole family was involved in it. They had become filthy rich and extremely powerful because they controlled so much of the economy of Jerusalem and the Jewish nation, even with the Romans being there. So he had a lot of power when the Romans ousted him, and so he was set aside as far as being in the official role, but he solidified his power and actually increased it by passing this role through his sons. Now he's got a lot more people involved and a lot more real power. John MacArthur says that he was the evil mastermind behind the corruption in Jerusalem and the impending death of Jesus. As far as the leaders were concerned, he was the kingpin. We think of kingpins as being kingmakers sometimes, but in this case, he was going to be a king killer by killing the King Jesus on the cross. So the first place they go after they catch Jesus and capture him, or whatever word you want to put on it, bind him and take him away, is to the real power, Annas. This is like the backroom meeting. We got the guy. Here he is. What are we going to do with him? Now, why was he in front of Annas? Well, they've got a problem. What's the indictment against Jesus at this point?
He claims to be God.
Well, they didn't accuse him of that yet. There is no indictment. They have. There is no charge to take to Jesus into the courts.
Jealous like him, as they've done indictment.
Well, and so the very people, the Sanhedrin, the scribes and Pharisees, the high priestly organization, the power people, what have they been doing for the last year or more?
Plotting
to kill him. They have already pronounced the death sentence, because they're the court too. Right? They've already pronounced the death sentence. The only charge is, we don't like him. Caiaphas' comment, more expedient for one to die than to have the whole nation in trouble. That was what we read just a minute ago. The words were, it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people. Now, when he said this, God was using him, because that actually was a prophetic utterance given by a very unregenerate man, but God used that because he spoke almost like the Pope speaking ex cathedra. This is the high priest announcing this. The high priest is the primary link between God and men, right? By the way it was established. And here he is really announcing what Jesus' role is going to be. Now, that isn't the way he meant it, but in effect, that's what he said. But they've got no charge against him. So they drag him in front of Annas to figure out what in the world are we going to do when we go in front of the official court here. And so that's a big part of what Annas is going to be doing. Now skip on down in John 18. Let's read 19 through 24. This is Annas yet with Jesus there. Remember, you keep the title High Priest for life. Somebody read 19 through 24. Yeah, John 18, 19 through 24.
The high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. Jesus answered him, I spake openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple, whether the Jews resort continually, or whereto the Jews taught continually. And in secret have I said nothing. Why askest thou me? Ask them which heard me, what I said unto them. Behold, they know what I said. When he had spoken these things, one of the officers which stood by smote Jesus with his rod, saying, Answerest thou the high priest so? Jesus answered him, If I have evil spoken, bear witness of the evil. But if I have well spoken, why smitest thou me? Now Annas had sent him bound unto Caiaphas the high priest.
Okay, so they've got Jesus in front of him. They're trying to get things set up for the trial that's going to come in front of Caiaphas. I mean, that's where he sends Jesus, so obviously that was a part of their plan. I would think that's a fair deduction. So the high priest in verse 19 is questioning Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Jesus said, hey, I've done all my teaching in public. Why are you asking me? Go back to the rules of the court. Even if Jesus said, I've said thus and so, and without more witnesses, it was meaningless. But secondly, there's no charge yet. So some people call this the arraignment, where they're coming to figure out what are we going to charge him with. That may or may not be correct, I don't know, but no matter how you look at it, here's Annas trying to figure out, trying to somehow drum up from Jesus something he can pin on him, so when he goes to Caiaphas, this thing's going to run down the rails nice and smoothly. He doesn't get it. Jesus, in effect, calls him on his methods and says, this isn't legal. You're supposed to be asking witnesses, not me. Bring charges, bring witnesses. And, of course, then they struck Jesus, which was not a part of what the courts were supposed to do. So Jesus calls him out on that. If you struck me for what I said, then bring the testifiers to say that what I said was wrong. I did all this openly. Why are you doing this in secret? Jesus said, I didn't say anything in secrets. Why are we in secret here? Supposed to be public trial, right? Where are they? They're at Caiaphas or at Annas' house. So Annas doesn't get anywhere with him. I mean, there is nothing in this that shows Annas has made any progress other than he got a lick or two in through his servant on Jesus in terms of striking him. So he left him bound and sent him on to Caiaphas the high priest. So that was the first trial, arraignment, whatever the right label is to put on top of that. Now we're going to go over and look at Mark, because when it goes to Caiaphas, that's what Mark records. So go back to Mark chapter 14. Okay. And we'll get into our passage. All of that, 35 minutes or so, to set up so we could work our way through this. And so when we start looking there in Mark 14, verse 53, we see that they led Jesus away to the high priest. Now this time, they're talking about Caiaphas. And all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes gathered together. That gathering together, that's the root word for Sanhedrin there. So they've got them all together. By the way, what time of the day is this? What's that?
Night.
It's the middle of the night.
It's right after they arrested or took him from the pardon, right?
Yep. We know that it's after dark, right?
At 2 or 3 in the morning.
Well, it's got to be before 3 o'clock. And how do we know that?
Because the
rooster hasn't crowed.
That's right.
And Peter hasn't been recorded as making his denial of Christ. And that happens by about 3 o'clock in the morning. So we're before 3 o'clock in the morning. Just take on a sinister act. We knew this was sinister. I mean, it's nothing new here that we're saying it's sinister. But was this legal? No. Okay. So they've got them all together. Now, verse 54, we get this. Oh, I better back up. I had a couple more questions. What day is it?
It's the day before.
It's the day before Passover, isn't it?
Well, after midnight, depends on which Jewish group you're in. You're either the day before Passover or you're actually in Passover.
It's the day before, and I'm in that group before.
Okay, all right, fine. Take it however you want. But regardless of which Jewish way you want to count when the Passover starts, some would start at sundown, some would start at midnight, but anyway, no matter how you count it, it is not a legal day for a trial, is it? They couldn't start this trial with when they arrested him until after the Passover. And yet they had everybody gathered together. Judas had set this thing up. They knew that They're very intentional. And these things were deep-rooted. They did not break these rules for how they conducted their courts, except for Jesus. So they got them all gathered together. Verse 54, we get this sidebar about Peter. He'd followed at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest, was sitting with the officers and warming himself by the fire. So Peter's at a little bit of a distance, but the way that that the compound was probably constructed. Remember, we're in a rich man's home, right? This is a son-in-law of the money bags. They're running the temple. They're fleecing the people. They've got the cash. They're like the rum runners of their day. Maybe not the runners, but the people at the top were making all the money. So here they are with all this money. Most probably a person in that situation almost certainly would have a house that was built in a big square with a courtyard in the middle. And then they would have big rooms around the outside. So the trial was probably going on, or this Jesus in front of Caiaphas was probably in a big room, but they probably had this fire outside in the courtyard. That would have been kind of in the center. So here he was, and he was sitting with who? The Roman officers. That's what this term officer means, is the Roman folks. And warming himself at the fire. So Peter's keeping what I'm sure to him felt like a safe distance. I mean, he wasn't right in there beside Jesus going, "Hey, what are you doing?" He was protecting himself, but it wasn't as safe a distance as he needed, or as he thought it was. But we'll find that out next time. So there's Peter there too. Now the chief priests and the whole council in verse 55 were trying to obtain testimony against Jesus to put him to death, and they were not finding any. Now, that's an interesting statement. They were trying to do what? What's Jesus charged with at this point?
Nothing.
So they're trying to put him to death for what?
Nothing.
So they're trying to find a charge. So that's a problem, number one. Number two, by everything that's written, I mean, the commentators all say they were almost certainly bribing these people. They were bringing them, telling them what to say. But things were happening too fast. And they didn't take enough time to get their stories lined up. So even as they testified, according to this, verse 56, for many were giving false testimony. So we know they were lying, right? That's the deal. By the way, to do what to Jesus?
To
put him to death. So what should these people have received as a punishment for this false testimony? Obviously, they felt comfortable that the court was going to protect them. They weren't going to get called on this. But their testimony was not consistent. You know, if you're going to go out and get false testimony, at least drill them enough that they'll say the same thing. But they didn't succeed in that. And I think part of that is God was not going to let them succeed in that. So it would be clear what was going on. But so there in verse 56, they are out there trying to get false testimony. We're not going to turn to it, but Matthew 26, if you read this same account, they talk about soliciting false testimony. It's a much more direct word than here. So we know they were out beating the bushes to get people to come in and not give just testimony, but soliciting false testimony. So they knew what they were doing. And their goal is to put him to death. Are they trying to render a fair decision? No, they just want to kill him. And we're just looking for how we're going to do it, does he deserve it? And so in verse 57, some stood up and began to give false testimony against him, saying, so some of the people, I think they were sensing, this is kind of the feel I get. Okay, here's these false testifiers. They get up. This thing should be a lock. They get up. And what do they say? Things that are inconsistent. Well, that ain't going to work. We don't have two witnesses lining up here. So somebody feels like they need to get up and kind of help the cause. You've seen those kinds of situations. And so they get up and say, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without hands. Well, now we know that's false. Did Jesus say that? Now, what did Jesus say? Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Was he talking about the physical temple? No, of course, and yet in AD 70, they'll destroy that physical temple, but that is not what he was talking about. So, and it's still not raised up, so a little more than 3 days has gone by. But so they're out there saying this, but even in this respect, their testimony was inconsistent. Something about how they told this story didn't line up, and so they were not successful in their efforts to get a hold of Jesus. And so this is a problem. Where is the court right now? They're meeting in the middle of the night. They've got a man in front of them with no charges against him. They already know his sentence. They don't know his crime, and they don't have any witnesses that they could legally use. They're meeting on the Passover, or the day before, however you want to count the days. I mean, add it up. Oh, they're supposed to provide a defense. Where's his defense? They cannot make their own charges. I mean, you can just go down. Everything about their whole court system is being just run over with this whole thing. So, verse 60. You know, Annas, I don't know if we want to say he got desperate, but was he successful when Jesus was in front of him as far as getting something lined up?
No.
No. Is Caiaphas having better luck?
No.
Even with all the work they're doing and their willingness to get people to lie about it, they're still stuck. So in verse 60, and in the first part of 61, Annas stands up, the high priest stood up and came forward and questioned Jesus, saying, "Do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you?" But he kept silent and did not answer. We're going to look at a passage in a minute that explains a little bit about why he didn't answer. But from their legal system, was he obligated to answer?
No.
He's not expected to bring anything, to say anything to that would cause him to be considered guilty or accused. Go over to Isaiah 53:7. You all know this, but let's just read it for ourselves so we remind ourselves the prophecy about Jesus not answering his accusers. Isaiah 53:7.
He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shears is silent, so he opened not his mouth.
What's Jesus' goal in this trial?
To die.
Is his goal, so let me say it another way, and it lines up a little bit with what Don said. Is his goal to be justly decided to be released?
No.
He knows he's not. So, what is the goal? Well, we're not told. But clearly by his behavior, he in a sense is calling them out on their own lack of following their own rules. Interestingly enough, God didn't give them the rules that they have established over the years, really very early on in the life of the Jewish nation, for these court systems. God gave them the direction to be just. The very limited rules he gave them was that you're not to have bribery and you're not to put up with false testifiers. That's all God really told them. Out of that, the Jewish people came up with one of the most fair, just systems that were around, because most everybody else, you went in front of one person and they just decided. And so they've got a great system comparatively, and even compared to what we have. We might balk a little bit that, well, if all the jurors say that he's guilty, then he goes free. But other than that, we would go, this was a good system. Yes, sir?
Well, I'd say it's good in the sense it's a system, but it wasn't good in the sense that men are running it, so it's none of them are any better. It's like government.
True, but it's a good system. And if it's followed, it's going to work well. And they were very diligent about following their own rules. But Jesus, this is my own imagination, okay? But when Jesus is silent in front of Caiaphas, I almost think he gave him a look. It's like, you know, like, really? Are you, you know better. I think there's some quiet, silent communication going on here. You guys are perverting your justice system. And that's what his silence may indeed have said. So the last half of verse 61, Again, the high priest was questioning him, saying to him, "Are you the Christ?" Now, we know that's a Roman term for what?
Messiah.
Messiah, anointed one is what it means in the Roman words. That was the equivalent name for Messiah. Are you the Messiah? The son of the Blessed One. What does Blessed One mean?
God.
Why didn't he just say God? Jews did not use God's name because they were afraid they would use it inappropriately. So they had all these euphemisms for God. This was a key one. So he wasn't even willing to use the name of God. And I'm not saying that as an indictment. I'm just, that's what he's doing. So are you the Messiah? The son of the Blessed One. The son of God. Now, was Jesus required to answer that one?
Nope.
No, but he did. And Jesus said, "I am." What did he just use? He used the name of God.
Yeah.
This is the name Jehovah. Jehovah means I am. I am. And just so you don't miss it, "And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." He quoted the Old Testament when he said that. Let's read this question over in Matthew 26:63. The question that Caiaphas asks has a little bit more emphasis in the way Matthew records it. Matthew 26:63.
Jesus remained silent, and the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God."
Okay, and so we get a little bit more equivalency in the words there. It didn't say blessed, but said God in there. But I adjure you, oh, let me, I got it, 26:63, I got to see the words, I'm going to mess them up, 26:63. Rick, you got there and read it just before I got there. 63. But Jesus, and the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God." That is their strongest oath. I'm asking you to essentially swear by your grandmother, if you were in some dialects around our country, on the grave of your mother or whatever. This is the strongest. He was asking Jesus to swear by the Most High God, in effect. And that is the strongest statement, strongest demand for truth in the Jewish idiom that could be made. And so he's saying, on the very truth of God, are you the Christ? And of course, Jesus' answer is, I am. Which, of course, made them all real happy, right? No, they didn't like it when Jesus used the name of God. And Jesus' answer goes on, "You said it, I am." And he says, "You shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power." What is power there? God. "You're going to see me," Jesus said, "sitting at the right hand of God and coming with the clouds of heaven." There's a lot in here. We're not going to get to all of it by any stretch. But let's read Psalm 110:1. This is a very familiar passage to Jews in that era, they tell me. I don't know which Jew that's still alive they asked, but anyway, that's what the commentators say. Psalm 110:1. And Jesus used this verse, so Jesus used it like it was one that was common to them, so it makes sense that it was.
"The Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou at my right hand, until I make thine enemies thy footstool."
And so Jesus uses that visual image from that passage. "You'll see me at the right hand of God. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand." And in that passage, those are both names of God. One is Yahweh, and the other one we would translate in the New Testament, Kyrios, which often refers to Christ in the New Testament period. Let's go over to Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. Daniel 7, 13 and 14. Somebody go ahead.
In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of God or son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, and that will not pass away. And his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed.
So here Jesus is alluding to this passage in Daniel. What's the title in Daniel for Jesus? For the one in the vision, his Son of Man? Where is he at, and what kind of dominion does he have? With the Ancient of Days.
He comes in the clouds of
glory. Come in the clouds of glory, and gee, his dominion is forever and ever, and everybody worships him. So when Jesus gave this answer, if we were just talking in human terms, what should he have expected?
Get clobbered.
I mean, this is waving the red flag in front of the bull, using that analogy. I mean, he should have expected that this would incite them to the core.
Well, but wasn't that a charge they could have been ringing? Like, what shouldn't this have been their indictment?
It probably should have.
I just don't understand.
Well, first of all, this is kind of the Romans 1 kind of thing. They were given over to depraved minds. I mean, they were operating out of Satan's work and influence. They were not thinking clearly, or they would have at least got the story straight. I mean, there's a lot of ways they could have fixed this in human terms. But when we look past that, who's really orchestrating all of this?
God.
And who's his most strongest complicitor? Jesus. I lay down my life. There is going to be no question when this is over. In the minds of the participants, they rigged this thing. And so God is orchestrating this to make it very clear. These are evil men doing evil things, even in the eyes of mankind. Yes, sir.
So why are the, I guess if the Jews wanted to do this, why didn't they just do it? Were they scared of the Romans? Like, did the Romans have like a check on the Jewish system?
Well, first of all, they did. They had a check. The Jews could not legally put anybody to death anymore. That had to go through the Roman courts. And it had to be an offense. We'll have fun with this later on. It had to be an offense that the Romans would say was worthy of death, not one that the Jews just said so. The Jews couldn't just come and say, hey, we found this guy guilty and he needs to be killed. Go kill him for us. It didn't work that way. Another issue they had was, why didn't they arrest Jesus as he was preaching in the temple?
They're
afraid of the people. Jesus had a large following. So they somehow had to trump something up that they could look at the people and go, this guy's guilty and deserves to die. And whether the people bought it or not, they at least needed some sort of a foundation. If they had just killed Jesus, they would have expected, I don't know if they were right or not, but they would have expected the people would have revolted. Because your leaders don't get to just go around and murder people. So that's the issue there.
Especially popular people.
Especially popular people. I mean, don't forget, we're just a few days away from the triumphal entry.
Yeah.
The Messiah. Yeah.
And he spent his days in the temple drawing huge crowds after he'd cleaned the temple out. I mean, Jesus, in many respects, declared war on the Jewish leadership at the beginning of his ministry. He did it by clearing out the temple. He reemphasizes that just on shortly after his triumphal entry, he took and made cords and drove them out again. And pretty much it, people vary on this, but it's very likely this is a time when people would normally be coming in and being fleeced badly as they came and tried to make sacrifices and make offerings. And this court of Annas, they'd get thoroughly ripped off to buy animals and to do the things they needed to do in order to make these sacrifices. And it's not certain, but we don't ever get see in the scriptures where they set that back up during this week. Jesus continues to teach in that courtyard. So did the money changers and everybody stay out? I mean, has he just wrecked their finances for the month or for the week? I don't know. I'm not trying to say that happened, but it's not recorded.
Well, that would be good in the sense that people, as long as you feed their bellies and stuff, and they feel that they're getting a good break, they'd probably follow anybody. And if,
true.
If he actually did that and they weren't being cheated anymore,
yeah, they would have been happy with Jesus.
To admire him.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, the people, they were afraid of the people. And that's why they did the arrest in the middle of the night. They weren't going to take him in the temple. Well, it's the same reason they have him in court in the middle of the night. They don't want the people watching what they're doing here. You know how embarrassing this would be? Can you imagine if you had C-SPAN in there on this deal? I'm telling you. But anyway, so Jesus does this. I lost my place over here. Let me get back. So Jesus gives them that answer, and then the high priest says, what further? Tearing his clothes. Tearing clothes was a symbol for hearing blasphemy. And anybody could do that for any kind of blasphemy. There wasn't only blasphemy against God. But in this case, the high priest can only do it if it's blasphemy against the Most High God. And so that's what the high priest is symbolizing by tearing his clothes. And he says, what further need do we have of witnesses? He's going to let Jesus self-condemn now against a charge that hasn't even been made. You have heard the blasphemy. How does it seem to you? And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. Did they go through their voting procedure? Oh, and by the way, are they going to wait 24 hours before they execute the sentence? No. And so all these things are happening. The interesting thing here, by the high priest tearing his clothes, and I don't think he knew this. I think he knew Jesus was claiming it. But in reality, he was performing blasphemy because he had God right in front of him and he was saying he wasn't God. So in a sense, he is guilty of blasphemy at that point. He would probably not know that. So how did they react? Some began to spit at him and to blindfold him and to beat him with their fists and to say to him, prophesy. And so that's the way the Jews reacted. And then they hand him over to the officers who just continued to beat him with slaps in the face. We've got to go over and look at Mark 10, verses 32 through 34 is our conclusion. Mark 10, 32 through 34. Back in some of our previous study of the book of Mark, we get this from Jesus. I think this is fascinating about where it occurs. But first we'll look at the verses, and then we'll look at what occurs. Mark 10, 32 through 34.
And they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them. And they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, see, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise.
Jesus surprised at the spitting, at the slapping. Now, he knew it was coming. When he said, nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done, he knew it was coming. And he endured it anyway. You know, when we read in the scripture, greatest love hath no man than this, he laid down his life for his friends. In this manner, I mean, it just amplifies the gift that Jesus gave of sacrificing himself for the cross to be come under the wrath of God for your sins and for mine. Now, Jesus says this, and, you know, this is, I would think Jesus, you know, he was downcast to some extent. I don't know if downcast is the right word, but troubled in this time of prayer that we read about a few weeks ago leading up to these moments. And yet, what is the next thing we read recorded in the book of Mark? Verse 35 in chapter 10. James and John, the two sons of Zebedee, came up to Jesus saying, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." Don't you wish that they weren't just like us? I mean, really. This might make you just a little bit sad to be associated with people in the world that would be so insensitive. Jesus is going to go be killed and spit upon and scourged and mocked. And he's doing that for them, and they come up here and go, "We want you to do whatever we ask." Don't you know what he's really going to do? No, and they didn't. They obviously didn't get it. So anyway, any questions, comments? Well, I hope you found it worthwhile to look at some of the details about how their legal system worked. We've gone through two of the three encounters in front of the Jews. We'll continue more next time. So let's close with a word of prayer. Father, we cannot fathom what it meant, what it cost for Jesus to go to the cross on our behalf. Jesus, we thank you for enduring, for laying down your life, and for picking it up again, that we can be sure that your sacrifice was complete and adequate. Lord, forgiving us for being a little bit too much like the 12 from time to time. But Lord, we pray that you would lead us into being like the 12 after the Spirit was cast upon them, that they became your witnesses throughout the world. Lord, lead us to be good testifiers of who you are. And in the midst of all the turmoil in the world right now, Lord, let us be very certain foundational people that others might turn and see that we have no fear of even death itself as followers of Christ. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.